Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I'll be speaking with Tim Sale, an assistant professor of history at the University of Toronto. We'll be discussing his terrific new book called Enduring Alliance, A History of NATO and the Post-War Global Order. It was published this year by Cornell University Press. NATO is one of those organizations that we hear a lot about every day in the discourse, in the press, but surprisingly, few historians have tackled the organization. Tim Sale corrects this as he looks at NATO from its founding in the 1940s all the way through to the post-Cold War period. Taking his readers to the inside of member state governments, as well as NATO negotiations themselves, Sale shows how NATO wasn't just any international organization. It was, he writes, an instrument of great power politics and the basis for Pax Atlantica. The book should be of interest to military historians, international historians, Cold War historians, and historians of global governance. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Tim Sale about his fantastic new book called Enduring Alliance, A History of NATO and the Post-War Global Order. Thanks for speaking with us today, Tim.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dexter. Thanks for having me on today.
Well, thank you for writing such an interesting book about a topic that historians have surprisingly not done a lot of research on.
Oh, thanks. It's sort of striking in a way. There are a lot of political science texts on NATO and a lot of journalistic accounts, especially dealing with NATO in the post-Cold War era, a lot of think tank reports from the Cold War. And while there are a few major historians who've dealt with NATO from a historical perspective, it really hasn't received the same attention as other aspects of international relations or U.S. foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really want to talk about that. But to begin, I want to ask you how you ended up becoming a historian of NATO.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. So I am a Canadian by birth and by background. And one of the funny things about NATO is that everyone thinks they know something about it. And their sense of what they know about NATO is often based on their nationality. And so the idea of a student studying NATO in Canada at the time was really not exceptional. But I did my PhD at Temple University in Philadelphia. And it took some convincing, I think, to make the case that NATO was a worthy subject for a dissertation. So the path wasn't entirely straight or clear. So coming from Canada, it was just seems like everybody is writing papers about NATO in undergraduate and graduate school. And then in the United States, it's often sort of an addendum to another story or a larger story about U.S. foreign policy. But I decided that it was something that combined my interests at the time a graduate student, and I thought there was room to tackle some questions. And something we can talk about a little bit later is that I thought that I would be bringing some new lenses to the study of NATO. I really expected that this was going to be a transnational history, and the research led me in an entirely different direction. So there were surprises all along the way for me.
Yeah, I would love to discuss some of those surprises or stories from the archive or aha moments. Because as you mentioned, this was originally a dissertation. So I imagine a lot changed between your original conceptualization of the project and the product that I read over the weekend.
Yeah, I think that's right. There are some changes. So one change for me as a dissertator or as a graduate student writing my dissertation had to do with methodologies in a way. I knew I'd be spending a lot of time in archives, and I was excited about that. But as a graduate student, you know, one's often thinking about the conversations in the field that they're going to join. Mm-hmm. And I thought NATO, you know, it's often surrounded by this rhetoric and language of transatlanticism, of an Atlantic Commonwealth, of these links between often men, but also women involved, their personal links, their cultural links. And so I thought this was going to be a dissertation that looked at or used sort of a transnational concept to understand power politics. And as I went through the archives, there was some reference to those connections, but I just kept on being overwhelmed by the national interests and the state interests that were used to justify maintaining the alliance and maintaining individual allies' membership in the alliance. So it started to look to me more and more like a vehicle, a sort of lowest common denominator of national interests that were all met by NATO as the best way of trying to explain how it continued. And so that took me on a whole different path, but it, by having both ideas in mind, is this transnational or national interests motivating the maintenance of this alliance, it just provided sort of brackets for me to examine my research and to carry on and really think about what I was looking at in these records. So that was one big change I experienced. And intriguingly, it sort of mirrors a debate that happened in the alliance in the first decade, especially in the 1950s, where there were people in the United States State Department, for example, who really sensed that the North Atlantic countries we're coming closer and closer together, not only in the security realm, but also as far as economics and even politics. So there were some true believers in the State Department, if you will, who saw a future for an Atlantic Commonwealth or an Atlantic community. But at the same time, there were people within often these same governments, and I'm speaking specifically here about the U.S. government, who didn't believe that. And I try and trace some of that in the book, as I did in the dissertation, that you have different individuals within the same state who think that NATO works for different reasons and think that it will survive for different reasons. So this sort of transnational versus international debate is playing out in governments, at least early in the alliance, just as it plays out in our discipline today.
Mm-hmm. And were there like any particular archives that helped you or triggered this rethinking of the project away from thinking in transnational terms to thinking more in national terms?
Well, one of the things that was most fascinating for me was that because the alliance is large, I mean, it's growing over the Cold War and, of course, growing after the Cold War, there are an enormous number of national archives with holdings related to NATO. Then there is, of course, the NATO archives. And then there are personal papers at universities and other places of officials who either worked for NATO or worked for their state at NATO. And I found the sort of peculiarity of the alliance is that I would sometimes need to look at four or five different archival collections to understand even a few weeks of diplomacy at NATO. And my first bite of the apple here was to think about the Berlin crisis. And I devote a whole chapter of the book to the Berlin crisis. And at the NATO archives, I would find some minutes of a meeting at the Canadian National Archives, Library and Archives Canada. I would find an informal copy of the minutes that had some more details. I'd find a briefing note at the American archives. And then I found the British archives, the Foreign Office, kept brilliant records, and they were also some of the biggest gossips going, it seems. So they were often able to capture a lot of the personalities and the individuals and what shaped these meetings. So I found often triangulating and often with more than three sources, just what exactly happened in NATO. Because the nature of the records kept varied by who was keeping them. I mean, this is common for a lot of different approaches to history, but it's really extreme in the NATO case. I thought the formal documents, the informal documents, the recollections. And so trying to understand the alliance from a number of different perspectives was fascinating, but it also let me see these sort of commonalities emerge over time.
Mm-hmm. And so just so that we're all on the same page, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the origins of NATO. Can you tell listeners where NATO comes from, what the original motivations were that tied, North America to Western Europe into a formal alliance?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question, and it's a tricky one. And I try and make the case in the book that sort of the basic idea of maintaining peace in Europe through an American treaty commitment to Western European states, dates back to before the Second World War. We have these ideas, indeed draft treaties at the end of the First World War for an American commitment. And of course, those don't come to pass. And so I do spend some time trying to understand just what motivates these states to ally at the end of the 1940s. And I'll explain that in a sec, but I want to say that thinking through what happens in the late 1940s was extremely instructive for me in thinking through why generation after generation of diplomats, presidents, and prime ministers thought NATO needed to be maintained. So I think the origin story is extremely important because it also helps explain the maintenance story, why NATO continues, and then why NATO survives the end of the Cold War. And what's happening, of course, in the late 1940s are a series of crises, the coup in Prague in Czechoslovakia, later the Berlin airlift. The tensions at this time are so high that there's obviously concern in Western Europe and in the United States about Soviet intentions, but whether the Soviets are trying to expand their influence and control into Western Europe. But what I think is key to realize is that they're not necessarily talking about invasion. They're not talking about the Red Army rolling west into Western Europe. They're really worried about the political influence of the Soviet Union in Western Europe, and possibly indigenous communist groups in Western Europe taking on policies that either separate them from their neighbors and possibly join them more closely with the Soviet Union. And there's sort of the untold story, I think, or one of the most important examples of what's happening here has to do with two states that are don't often receive a lot of attention in our histories of the early Cold War, and they're Finland and Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviets come to an agreement with Finland. It's going to give us this phrase later, Finlandization, this idea that Finland will develop its own domestic policies, but that its foreign and defense policy is really sort of subcontracted or contracted to the Soviet Union, that the Soviets influenced the Finnish role in the world. And in the late 1940s, the Norwegian government expects and is told essentially that the Soviet Union is going to make offer one of these deals that the Norwegians couldn't possibly refuse. And the Norwegians approach the Americans, the British, and the Canadians
in a plea for help, really, in a plea for the need for states to work together so that, you know, we'll have this phrase later in the Cold War, that these states aren't susceptible to salami tactics. They're not going to be sliced off one by one by not a Soviet invasion again, but sort of the threat of Soviet force or bullying or blackmail, if you will. So there's the sense that the states of Western Europe need to combine and that they need to be supported by the United States. And it's Ernest Bevin, the British Foreign Secretary at the time, who is going to be the most important in making a proposal for some sort of union or a security agreement to bring the United States into this emerging Western European security architecture. And sort of the last thought on this that I think is so crucial is that Bevin explains in his case to the Americans that this looks to him like the late 1930s. And I don't think this is an overwrought comparison. His point was that the balance of power in Europe could shift as a result of these salami tactics as European states were one by one sort of added to or came under Soviet influence. The balance of power in Europe could shift so much that the Americans and the British decided that war was the only option for them to maintain their interests in Western Europe. And this is something that carries on, this sort of argument carries on over decade after decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the striking things about your book, the role of history and historical memory in how the organization operated. You know, thinking about like the lessons of the 1930s, but then also just looking at all of the personnel that you know were leading the Allied forces in D-Day, and then you know in the 1950s they're running NATO. You really situate the historical actors in your book in their own history and in their own historical memories, and I thought that was really useful.
Yeah, thanks, Dexter. I mean, it is an interesting, it has an interesting problem in that these people who create NATO and then do so much to maintain it believe the alliance is necessary because of their experience in war. But their worry going forward is that generations to come who didn't live through first the Second World War and then other events won't understand why the alliance is necessary. So there's this ongoing fear in the alliance that a new generation just won't get it. And it's fascinating to me because this carries on into even more recent periods where Robert Gates, the United States Secretary of Defense, in a major speech warns about a new generation that didn't live through the Cold War not understanding why NATO was important. So there's this fascinating tension in these individuals between their lived experience and their understanding of why the alliance is necessary, and then their fear that generations after just won't get it.
Mm-hmm. But what's really striking about that is that almost leads into almost like an anti-democratic sensibility, where the really big fear is that you know, these citizens, you know, living in democratic states in Western Europe aren't actually going to vote for, you know, all of the expenses that NATO requires. They're not going to consider, they're not going to continue their support of, you know, the United States military having such vast, you know, outlays in Western Europe. And some of your NATO leaders even try to think about how they can like insulate NATO from those democratic majorities.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one thing that I liked sort of grappling with during the project, is that NATO is often referred to as an alliance of democracies, or an argument that because most of the states were democratic, this gave the alliance some life. And in very broad general terms, you know, there's something to this, and I don't want to ignore it entirely. But I really did come to the conclusion that the greatest challenge to NATO and to keeping the alliance going was at the ballot box and trying to ensure
that states that leaders weren't pushed by their public, either in elections or through other sort of general political pressure, to stop paying for defense, to leave the alliance, to give in to these possible Soviet demands that Allied leaders were worried about time and time again. And this is, yeah, closely connected to that idea of generational change and that voters won't understand why the alliance is necessary. And the I really struggled or debated whether to bring in the concept and phrase balance of power when I was describing why NATO was necessary, because it's often sort of, you know, associated with other centuries, previous centuries, and a sort of old school approach to international relations. But it's useful here, I think, because the leaders of the Allied states were concerned about the balance of power, but the thing that would shift the balance of power in the second half of the 20th century wasn't invasions or the conquering of territory so much as changing political alignments. So you have democracy in the 20th century being a major, we don't even have to say threat, but a major factor in affecting the alignment of the balance of power on the continent. And the Allied leaders were very, very sensitive to this.
Do you have a particular example of NATO leaders being anti-democratic or trying to insulate NATO from democratic demands?
Well, I think the phrasing is important here. And I mean, just for the sake of discussion and argument, I'll push back against anti-democratic and say instead that the leaders were just very, very sensitive to the limits on their policy imposed by politics. Democracy, especially, and, you know, the idea of voting and changing governments. And so one key example here would be the growing emergence of the European, it's not the emergence of the economic community in Europe, but the growing power of the European economic community in the 1970s, the size and the strength of trade within Europe, and President Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger's fear that trade disputes with Europe would cause congressmen and congresspeople in the United States to push back against the Europeans by limiting their commitment to NATO. So that would be one example of how sort of democratic institutions could be involved in a dispute that would lead to the end of NATO.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to take a step back and talk about the role of crisis in your book and in the broader history of NATO, because what your book really does show is just like the seemingly never ending series of crises that NATO experienced, and at times the whole Western alliance seems rather precarious. You know, you have like the intra-alliance conflicts, you have, you know, between like the French and the US, but then you also have, you know, as we've talked about, the problem of popular legitimacy. And then, of course, there's, you know, the Cold War rivalry with the Soviet Union. And so I was wondering if you could just sort of expand on the role of crisis in your narrative.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. There are all sorts of crises that affect NATO. Some of these crises, the crises between allies, revolve around debates about just what the alliance is for. Even if the Allied leaders are all agreed that it's necessary to keep the alliance together to protect really fundamental security interests, at different times throughout the Cold War, different states have ideas as to how NATO can also help them with their other problems. Whether it's dealing with the collapse of their empire or other things. So in some ways, some of these crises come from trying to use NATO to accomplish national interests that other allies aren't interested in. Charles de Gaulle, the French issue has to do with France, a French policy to assert leadership in Europe, but also to maintain a government amidst national crises in France, like in Algeria. And so NATO becomes sort of a useful punching bag for the French, and in the way that I'd argue Donald Trump uses NATO as a punching bag now to sort of drum up support for himself, sort of separate from any real concerns about NATO. And then, yes, there are these crises and showdowns with the Soviet Union, and the one I spend the most time on is Berlin. It's really the one that shows the precarity of the alliance, I think, because the Allies were not all agreed on the value of fighting for Berlin. And that creates quite a bit of bitterness in the alliance. This is in the early 1960s. And I think it's a real marking point for the Allies in thinking about just what the alliance is for and what it can be. And it's going to remain a basic tool for maintaining the balance of power. And it's not going to be a vehicle for Atlantic community or Commonwealth.
So I want to zoom in on something that you just mentioned, which is the collapse of empire. So when NATO was founded, like, there weren't just nation states, there were also empires. And so what was the relationship between NATO and empire, NATO and decolonization, and the problems that empire posed for NATO?
Right. Well, they're very thorny, and they're thorny right from the beginning. Even though it's Harry Truman's Democratic administration that's in power at the signing of the treaty and during the negotiation, there's a bipartisan consensus to go with NATO. And John Foster Dulles, who's later Eisenhower's Secretary of State, plays a role in moving the treaty through the Senate. And part of his efforts that are going to have important implications later on are convincing the Senate and Americans that NATO is not a tool for maintaining and upholding empire. And he believes this personally, but he also believes this politically, in that he doesn't think the United States will support a treaty organization, a treaty, and then a treaty organization that's job is maintaining empire. He doesn't think the American people will support that. And he also comes to grow worried that if NATO becomes too closely associated with empire, that's going to reflect badly on the United States in their sort of global Cold War. And that if NATO comes to appear to be an instrument of empire, it's going to push non-NATO states closer to the Soviet Union, which you know, spent so much energy and rhetoric championing the end of empire. So empire is twisted up in the alliance from the very beginning. It's complicated, however, because even the Algerian departments of France are initially included in the treaty and then later removed. So empire is going to be a major, major issue for the alliance in the 1950s and sort of culminating in the Suez Crisis. One thing that I was very surprised to learn and I write about is that there had been some sort of inklings or rumblings about whether NATO would have a role in opening or maintaining the opening of the Suez Canal. There's some rumblings in the State Department, and even President Eisenhower says something about NATO possibly having a role in the Suez Crisis. But very quickly, John Foster Dulles' attitude takes control here, and there's a decision, really clear decision in the U.S., that NATO can't be associated with this major end of empire showdown with Egypt in 1956. And it's in this period, sort of 1956 to 1960, that Eisenhower and Dulles recognize that NATO must stay away from these allies who are trying to maintain their empires, be it the French, be it the Belgians in the Congo. The Belgians try and argue that some of their air bases in Congo are NATO air bases, trying to pull the alliance into supporting their efforts there. but that's the decision made. And it's fascinating, of course, because it gets flipped in the 1960s when the United States comes to be embroiled deeper and deeper in Vietnam and looks to NATO allies for support. And now the tables have turned. Now the Europeans are the ones who don't want extra European involvement for the alliance.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so moving on just a little bit, a relatively similar theme, I was really struck by how, despite the peace in Europe, despite how bloodless the Cold War was in Europe, it was unbelievably contentious. And we know from historians of the global Cold War that this period was obviously very deadly, but it was deadly in mostly Asian and other non-European geographies. Did NATO leaders ever consider the asymmetry of violence between the European continent and the Third World? It's an odd question, or a big question, but I was hoping you could say something about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so it's a fascinating question, and there are a few different sort of elements to this. One is that initially, and there's talk of this in the late 1940s, and of course in the 1950s, is that there needs to be more NATOs, right? There needs to be more alliance systems to keep the peace elsewhere in the world. So in some ways, there's an argument, falls away after about a decade in the 1950s, but this argument that this type of solution that's working in Europe is what's needed elsewhere. And that's resisted elsewhere in the world for a number of reasons. And it's also resisted by NATO allies, who some of whom are quite unwilling to get mixed up in what seem like imperial efforts abroad. But what I think is crucial a little bit later on in the Cold War is that especially American presidents come to recognize that maintaining NATO and thus maintaining peace in Europe gives them power elsewhere in the world. Richard Nixon sort of puts this very clearly when he says that NATO gives the United States or gives him as president a diplomatic wallop, because he's not worrying about the outbreak of war in Europe. He's able to direct his attentions to his diplomacy with the Soviet Union and with the People's Republic of China. And he makes this case to members of Congress. He says, we need to maintain NATO because peace in Europe lets us exercise our power elsewhere in the world. And the sort of fascinating corollary to that is that in the last year, in 2019, as there have been more and more calls for an appraisal of NATO or a reappraisal of NATO, there are some that argue one of the reasons that the United States should detach itself from NATO is that the peace in Europe, and especially the NATO, American NATO bases in Europe, make it too easy for the Americans to exercise power abroad. And it has led, in their view, to mistakes and an ease of action in Iraq and Afghanistan that wouldn't be available to the United States if they didn't have these bases in Europe. And I think you could extend that to say if they didn't have this sort of sense that Europe was under control, if you will. So yes, there's a connection between NATO and global affairs, and there's a connection between NATO and what the United States especially is able to do abroad, and other allies too, right? The NATO allowed France in the early Cold War to send much larger troop deployments to Indochina and then to Algeria than they would if they were maintaining defensive positions along the Franco-German border. So there are connections, but we have to sort of step back to see them. They're not always explicit in the records.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And there's just another, I guess maybe I'll call it a paradox in your book, which is the support for NATO seems to be challenged when Cold War relations thaw.
Right.
So basically when relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union are good, or at least better, there is a pretty big existential fear within NATO that that will actually reduce support for NATO. So I think at a certain point in the book, you say that NATO was a victim of its own success. Can you elaborate on this dynamic?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, a bunch of times during the Cold War, NATO officials and leaders are wondering if they've put themselves out of business, whether they've made it seem like they're no longer necessary. And it's not so much that they think this is a bad thing, but they're not sure that they are unnecessary. And you're exactly right. This happens at a few different points. And quite often during these thaws in the Cold War, what I was surprised to see in the records of NATO conversations between allies was concern that these thaws were really Soviet traps. And there's a Soviet smile in the 50s, the detente of the late 60s. This wonder and concern that possibly the thaw with the Soviet Union is designed or will have the consequence of breaking up the alliance and it's being done purposefully by the Soviet Union. So that fear never goes away. It doesn't even go away with the end of the Soviet Union. And part of the reason is that this goes back to the power politics argument and the balance of power is that these officials don't think that NATO is essential only because of the communist ideology of the Soviet Union, or only because they're worried that Germany will, as one official said, return to the bottle, but because they believe there are realities of power politics and that even without the ideology, without NATO, there would still be scrambles for power within Europe, and NATO helps keep a lid on that. Mm-hmm. So this idea that NATO's put itself out of business is a major concern. But as one British ambassador writes in the 1970s, every time NATO gets itself in trouble, the Russians come along and bail out NATO. So the British often refer to the Soviets as Russians, but this also carries on after the Cold War. A great example is the Suez Crisis of 1956, animosity within the alliance. And you know, almost instantaneously, Soviet armor rolls in to Hungary and reminds the Western Europeans of what the Soviets are willing to do to maintain their influence on the continent. So that's one good example. But Russian action in Crimea and the Ukraine, you know, seems to be another example of NATO being at a bit of a loss, trying to wonder what its purpose and viability was, and all of a sudden actions directed by Moscow sort of sharpening the focus of NATO leaders again on the alliance's importance.
I really appreciated at the end of the book how you reflected on some of the more recent history. But before we get there, I want to discuss one of the episodes in your book that I found to be really dramatic and also your explanation to be really compelling. And that's about why NATO survives the Cold War. So, you know, NATO was assembled, as you've already mentioned, in the context of a rivalry with the Soviet Union. But it seems to, you know, it survives the Cold War, it survives the Soviet Union, and in many ways, it actually expands. Can you talk about this moment, this transition?
Sure, absolutely. So this, the end of the Cold War and NATO's survival, but also NATO's expansion is the focus of an enormous amount of scholarship right now. By political scientists and also a number of pundits are weighing in on this, of course, because of the tensions in the region. And so there's quite a lot of work being done here, which is very exciting. But what I tried to do in the book was to try and put these events within the sort of broader historical perspective of NATO, to see how NATO had essentially faced similar crises before, faced concerns about its future before, and how they were applied at the end of the Cold War, and then also how policymakers applied their own historical reasoning to NATO, the need to maintain NATO at the end of the Cold War. And so there are a few different interlocking pieces here. One is the growth of what's going to become the European Union. There is a sense in Washington that European Union, what's going to become the European Union, is going to expand into Europe. And because of the close links between European NATO allies and these new members of the economic community, there'll be sort of a de facto obligation to protect these states anyway. And so better to do it within NATO. And that's something that dates back to Nixon and Kissinger's worries in the early 1970s about sort of Europe's relation with the United States, a growing Europe's relation with the United States. The second factor is that even if the Berlin Wall falls, and then later the Soviet Union itself is going to, we use the word collapse, but of course, even if the Soviet Union collapses into constituent pieces, there is still an enormous number of soldiers, tanks, and nuclear weapons to the east of NATO. So again, American policymakers don't think that power politics is going to disintegrate just because the Soviet Union has come apart into pieces. And then two more concerns. One is the future of Germany. There are still major concerns in amongst the Western European states about what Germany's role will be after the end of the Cold War, especially once it's unified. This is an enormously powerful state in some ways. And it's okay for the other Europeans that Germany is powerful because it is a part of NATO and all of the constraints that puts on the German military. But NATO's continuation continues to give Germany a home, a security home, and lessen the fears of its allies. And then the final point here, the historical thinking, is what is going to happen to these states that were a part of the Warsaw Pact, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary. And what's fascinating here is that memo after memo written by National Security Council staffers in Washington go back to the late 19th century and trace European history up through to the Second World War and consider how this region of Europe and this sort of fragile alliances built there over time played a role in war coming to Europe. Essentially, they're asking, now that these states are separated from the Soviet Union, where will they look for their security? And so already in the sort of very ashes of the Cold War comes this logic of expanding NATO to include those states so that they're not rebuilding a sort of rickety alliance system that policymakers, in their understanding of history, see as having led to war in Europe in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that really surprised me in your book, and maybe this comes from my own ignorance of the literature, is how NATO expansion was already being considered and being carried out under the Bush administration. It wasn't until the it wasn't just the Clinton administration that sort of launched the expansion. And you have some really interesting documents from Brent Scowcroft and Robert Gates about their reasoning and so on. And one of the things that struck me was how they were considering, again, the democratic majorities in Western Europe being opposed to U.S. Military architecture. And so they saw Eastern Europe as a potential, a really useful potential site for military bases that, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, they would be able to purchase these bases on the cheap, and they'd be able to station troops and so on. Yeah, and that's just something that I had no idea about. So I was glad to learn about it.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's fascinating because I try and make the case that the logic for expansion is apparent in those years, yet the primary goal regarding NATO and Eastern Europe in this period for the Bush administration is making sure that the Soviets leave. And if they were to too loudly or publicly discuss NATO expansion or the logic of this expansion,
they were worried that the Soviets might throw on the brakes, might be much less willing to start moving their troops out of the Warsaw Pact seat. So they're playing a very careful game. They are very careful not to say very much in public and not even in private to make any sort of commitment about expanding NATO. But you're right, there are so many cases being made for just how this makes sense, how the expansion makes sense from a strategic perspective.
Mm-hmm. And so as we're approaching the end of our conversation, I wanted to talk a little bit about the more recent history. So the question that I would like to pose to you is, how would a knowledge, or how should a knowledge of NATO inform contemporary discussions about security, about alliances, about international organizations? And this is something that you've already gestured to a little bit about so far, but I'd like maybe a bit more of an expansion on it.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I try and make a bit of a case, and I try and be provocative here and argue that there is real continuity between the post-Cold War world and the Cold War world for NATO. And I think that's true. But at the same time, there are differences. And some of those have to do with the roles that NATO takes on, and the deployment to Afghanistan is a real primary example of this. What's so fascinating about the post-Cold War world is that the handcuffs are off NATO when it comes to out-of-area operations. There's no more worry about pushing states into the embrace of Moscow, into the embrace of communist ideology. And so many of the restraints on NATO are gone in the post-Cold War world. And so I think there'd be real value in thinking again about the value of those restraints, of keeping NATO's focus. But I think the biggest takeaway from this series of repeated crises and worries about whether the alliance would survive is that if officials and governments today think that NATO serves a purpose, they need to do a better job of explaining to their citizens why they support the alliance. And time and time again, during the Cold War, officials are so frustrated that their citizens don't understand why NATO is important or why there needs to be nuclear weapons deployed in Europe. And I tell a story at one point of the British officials just trying to understand some antipathy towards NATO and nuclear weapons, both in Europe and in the United Kingdom. And you have to give them great respect because they recognize and they realize that they just hadn't done a very good job of explaining to their citizens why they'd conducted these policies for decades. So I think in the last year or so, NATO, the institution, has done much more to be visible, to be publicly visible. But I think that it falls upon NATO and then its governments, allied governments, to find ways to keep NATO in the minds of their citizens and explain just what's happening. Because it's the inclination of every generation to, of course, hope that peace is a default condition and that we've moved beyond power politics. But time and time again, you know, generation after generation of leaders has looked at all of the intelligence, they've looked at world affairs, and they've decided that a defense alliance like this is necessary. And it will be a lot easier to keep it in place if they can convince their public of that that need.
Wonderful. And so I think that's a great place to leave our conversation of your book. But I was hoping that you could perhaps share with our listeners what you're working on right now.
Oh, sure. Yeah. One project also coming out with Cornell University Press. It's going to be published in September. This is something I've worked on with a few other historians, Jeffrey Engel and Hal Brands and William Inwood. And what we did with some others was interview 28 members of the George W. Bush White House about the decision to surge troops into Iraq, the decisions made in 2006, and the troops are surged in 2007. So I took
these 28 interviews that are each about 75 pages long and organize them into 8 chapters of sort of readable oral history that take readers through the debates and the arguments and the policymaking that ultimately led to the surge, and then had a number of political scientists and historians analyze these transcripts as well, and their analysis is included in the book. So this was famously Condoleezza Rice called this the last card in the deck. So this book coming in September from Cornell is called The Last Card Inside George W. Bush's Decision to Surge in Iraq. So that's coming soon, and it's been a really exciting project. And I'm now moving to a study of American, British, and Canadian intelligence analysis and sharing during the Cold War.
Wow. I look forward to both of those projects. And I want to thank you for our conversation today.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Dexter. I really enjoyed it.
Of course. And you've been listening to New Books in History.